You can do very briefly. Was there any great contrast, or was it the same the way you raised your children as to the way you were raised?
If you speak of raising, of an activity on side of the parents, I don't think there was great contrast. We cannot say we. Ilse was entirely raised differently than I. She was under a despotic mother, and as mildernde Umstände, what's the word? Mitigating circumstances?
Yeah, mitigating circumstances.
Yeah. Her mother became a war widow, as I mentioned before, with 26, left with two little children and her mother. So she was extremely strict. So Ilse was brought up extremely strict and minimum of understanding for her personality. In my case, it was entirely different. There was no strictness I felt. It was, we were brought up more with an awareness of a certain amount of self-discipline in all fields.
And this is sort of the way you raised Barbara and
Yeah. We trusted them, and we weren't disappointed. And I must say, the kids are most affectionate today when they are in their 20s, and Stevie almost 30, which is not always the case.
We
have
a
very happy
life.
Well, unfortunately not, because we see Stevie only twice a year on the West Coast.
But you vacation together.
We vacation together and we talk plenty on the phone. Fortunately, we have IT&T, so it's not all thrown out. But our telephone bills are horrendous. However, that's the only way we are in contact, and we are in plenty of contact with both of them.
And the three
and
grandchildren.
Barbie comes, of course, occasionally to Pittsburgh. Pardon me?
And the three grandchildren. You talk to them
all
the time with them.
Yes, they come to the phone, and we love them. This is all right.
But seeing them twice a year is a good bit, considering the distance.
Yeah.
Your religious observances we really have covered. Are you affiliated now with?
If you don't mind, Mary, or must I say, Mrs. Harrison? Let me try a resume of our experience since we came over.
Religiously?
No, in every respect.
Do you like to
as Americans? Is that interesting
very,
for you?
Very.
I think that would end it. That would really.
Because that includes everything.
And that would encompass what you
have personally.
Yeah.
In one way, we are not religious in the way of keeping observance in the house with Friday evening candles and so on and so forth. So by virtue of Ilse's close connection with synagogues, he still is organist and choir director at Tree of Life, and in between, after Bnei Yisrael, she was also at Temple Sinai, so she knows all varieties. We naturally have a strong personal connection with the synagogue, which is not necessarily primarily religious, but rather a personal connection with the rabbis and the cantor. The rabbis, I say, because I loved Dr. Halperin. I respected him very much as a scholar, as a man, and as a very wise rabbi in his way. He is entirely different from Dr. Friedhof, who is something unique in the history of the rabbinates, I would say. I have the privilege of knowing Dr. Friedhof somewhat when he got an honorary doctor degree at St. Vincent. I got one years ago before there, so they asked me whether I would drive Dr. Friedhof out and bring him back and so on and so forth because, you know, of his eyesight. And we had a very good time on the trip and out there, and then on the trip back, because between the, he was a wonderful commencement speaker. There you see the liberalism of St. Vincent College. not only that they give an honorary degree to a rabbi, but that they have him as commencement speaker for a Catholic college. So they don't consider themselves Catholic college, they consider a liberal arts college, which happens to be on the camp, on the same ground with an arch abbey. And at that time, one of my closest friends, at that time was archabbot, a very young man, he's now 40, he's now the head of the Benedictine orders, residing in Rome under with the title and rank of Abate Primate. That means the rabbi, I almost said, abbot of all Benedictines, and which sounds very churchy, but he is not. I mean, he's a good priest, I'm sure of that, but he's the most modern man, and we are very close friends. For instance, when he was made archabbot, I never thought, I told him, forget it, you'll never become it, because as a musician, you're second class, and a young man, you're third class, some sedate person will be, you know, but they elected him. So there was a banquet for the faculty, lay faculty as well as the priests and so on, and guests, and I walked into the dining room, wanted to sit down, and he motioned to me. He was sitting on a small table, at a small table, with the president of the college. And I said, come on, Richard, you sit with us. I said, I can't do that, Rembert. Yeah, you look, the prior sits down there, the vice president sits down there. I cannot sit here with you. I want you to sit there. But look, you embarrass me. All right, so you're embarrassed. You sit here. I say, okay, I sit here as a representative of the Old Testament. I say, okay, sit down as a representative of the Old Testament. So then when he got up and said, in case anybody should doubt why Dr. Karp is sitting here, he's sitting here as a representative of the Old Testament. There you see his spirit. And when I visit him in Rome, it was so wonderful. For instance, he called me in the hotel. And while we talked, we made an arrangement that I see him the next day. And he said, but it has to be in the morning because I'm going to Paris at noon. I said, what are you doing in Paris? I want to set them straight that they should stop talking about the scriptures in their sermons and talk about a relevant subject of today. At that moment, the lights went out. There was a thunderstorm. The electricity went off. The telephone went off too. So 20 minutes later, he called back.
No wonder.
And I said, Father Rembert, that should be a lesson to you not to talk against the Old Testament. So you see, this is the way we stand. Or for instance, in that, it's a palazzo in which he lives, there's an entrance, ante-room. When I saw him the first time, it was filled with Baroque furniture from his predecessors, like in a Bavarian castle.
Is this in the Vatican?
No. It's in a Rome suburb. He's a constant in dispute with the Pope. I have a picture where they have a disputation about them, and somebody shot them, and I got a picture of that. He was elected against the wish of the Pope. No, let's put it this way. The Pope had another candidate. He was the other candidate, the counter candidate, and he was elected. Not the Pope's candidate. So the Pope is rather conservative, and Rembert is very progressive and liberal. So that's why the younger guard elected him. Now, where were we?
Just your whole religious. You said you were going to give us a whole resume.
We talked, of course, a lot about Judaism and Christianity and things like this.
Now, you were going to give us a resume of your life in the United States.
Yeah, this is a part of it.
Pittsburgh. No. You asked me. You were asking me where you were.
Yeah. Oh, I see. Well, I it won't be chronological. It will be just in retrospect. I mean, today, as you say, you interview me because I was lucky enough to be in a position to contribute to a community. in general, maybe to music in America, some in small part also. Okay, this is an, we are grateful for this, and we don't take it as a matter of course. We are grateful to being able to pay back that country which accepted all of us as equals and gave us opportunity as equals, in spite of rough times we went through. So who doesn't have rough times? That doesn't matter. But they all opened the doors to us. Now, I'm not speaking for me alone. Look at the Friendship Club, the organization of Jewish, mostly German emigrants in Pittsburgh. I don't think there's one poor person in the whole Friendship Club. They all made it somehow to stand on their own feet. And some made it very, very well, who are in very good circumstances. And I repeatedly say it, if the situation would have been reversed, that we would have been American Jews and had to get out of here and went to Germany, God forbid, at any times, the best time they would have accepted us, but we would have stayed foreigners all our lives. And how far we would have gotten, I don't know. As a foreigner in artistic fields, you're always in a somewhat in a favored position. But if you were in any other field, I don't know whether the doctors would have gotten the opportunities they got here, whether the merchants would have gotten the opportunities they got here, and so on and so forth. Here we know we got it. And so if I'm, as you say, I didn't say it, one of those who contributed something, well, I thank it only to the opportunity that the country gave me to do my best in my work. But there's something else. I can say that for Ilse too, became deeply interested in this country. Now, Ilse doesn't even want to visit Germany. Still, today. I still go alone over there. I hope I can convince her next year to come along. Because today's Germany is different. The guys of my generation are dying out or have nothing to say anymore. And the people of your generation are Weltbürger. 99%. They are only interested, they are citizens of the world. They speak all the languages because they spent, since their school days, including their school days, the vacations in hostels or something in Italy, in Spain, in France,
some in Israel,
in Israel, and Christian German in Israel. They learn languages not only in school. So every time you come to, when I come to Germany and hear the young people speak English, some of them speak better than I do, with less accent. It's incredible. So you don't have to be afraid to go to Germany. And I say they were very, very decent to us in contrast to Austria. I happened to be and was for a while a German civil servant in Düsseldorf as a municipal conductor, as what the title was. I was a civil servant. I still get my pension. And I get it with all the, how do you call it, living standard.
Oh, yes, it goes up. Oh,
yeah. Raises,
cost of living,
I get a notification, cost of living rise, I get education help for the children, for Barbie, up to her, including her master's degree, till May. No other country would have done that. Now that's the good side of Germany. If they do something, they do it methodically and right and unbiased. So I see that side of Germany. And when I come back, of course, I find very, very few people there whom I have known. They died because they had hard times too.
You mean the Gentiles?
Yes. The Jews, I didn't find anyone there. There are some Jews there. But, I mean, whom I know. There are some in Vienna, some cousins. But I don't get back to Vienna. just a personal thing. Like Ilse doesn't want to go back to Berlin. I don't want to see Vienna. And I don't trust the Austrians. They put a knife in me. See, a German, in Germany, when the Hitler thing came, I was called up to the I was a little guy. So I was called up to the chief conductor of the opera house, Mr. Ortmann, and he said, "You're a Jew, I'm a National Socialist. I have nothing against you personally, but I believe in the ideology of National Socialism." So they told you. But he was one of those ideal men. He shot himself when he saw what the Nazis really did. When he was head of the Berlin Volksoper, he shot himself. So the others were less ideal, they were opportunists. Goebbels and Goering, they would just as well have been Soviet ministers if they would have the opportunity. They were opportunists.
It had nothing to do with love of country.
Oh, quatsch. And many of them. So, but where were we? How did I get to them?
Well, you're going back.
So I don't think anybody has to be afraid to go or hold it anymore against Germany. And they vehemently, they do, for instance, the one thing which I resent. I have an cousin, they have still some family members in the younger generation who come from the non-Aryan aunts and so on, which I had, and which could stay there, and there's now the children. So one is a lawyer in Pittsburgh.
The Aryan
one. Non-Aryan. They married Aryan fathers.
Yeah.
Rather Aryan husbands. Yeah. So the children are non-Aryan, and they were too small, they didn't do anything to them. So one of them is a criminal lawyer in Düsseldorf. And I'm going to visit him again when I see him. And he told me, for some reason, his name is Löwenich. Doesn't mean anything. But he has a big nose, and for some reason they think he's Jewish. And he has a lot of Jewish clientele. And many of the Jews who live now in Germany, none of us would be proud of them, because they are displaced persons, which is nothing against them, from all kind of countries, who got stuck in Germany and liked it and stayed there. But now, and I'm not generalizing this, a few of them make their living in going to Switzerland and bring smuggling watches across this border and so on and so forth, you know? So I'm not generalizing, I want to make that clear. But he has some of those clients who come to him because they think he's Jewish and gets them off. Or something like that, you know? So that's why he knows about them. Naturally, he defends them as far as he can to get them a few years less or something like that. He can't say they did what they did is right. But then he observed that in cases, even if it concerns other criminal cases where Jews are involved, or civil cases, the judges lean backwards toward milder sentences for the Jews. And this is wrong again. They should not differentiate. They should say, "You're German, and I don't care whether you're Jewish or not German, this is the law, so and so. Goodbye." Because as soon as they start to differentiate in any way, they will possibly awaken another movement which says, "See, how their favorites again, or how they wiggle their way through. You know, we are being blamed for everything since we went into the diaspora." It's an old story. And I mean, anything goes wrong, it's the Jews in all countries.
So this worries you a little?
That displeases me. Nothing I can do about. It's up to the Jews, to the Christian judges. But they have now Jewish judges, they have Jewish lawyers, so not many, because there are not many there who want to do it. But in Austria, the president, either the president or the prime minister, is a converted Jew. The one who closed this camp, you know, where the Arabs made that ado about
the villa,
it.
The villa.
Yeah. He's a converted Jew.
He is. The mayor of Hamburg was Jewish also, up until a few years ago.
And So they really try to make good. Now, I'm not here to make a defense for Germany. So
this is part of your philosophy, though. And I think
let's go back to my American philosophy. It's much more important.
Art, your American philosophy, I would like not to interrupt. I would like to interject one thing into this, is whether what changes have occurred in the music population, in the music audience, when you were younger. What kind of an audience did you have? Has it changed today?
In America?
In the United States, yes.
Oh, it's changed tremendously.
It has.
Oh, tremendously.
I'd like to hear about it.
In the last 20 years, but this has nothing to do with Judaism or with our subjects. But generally speaking, I can tell you, since you asked me, and I observe it and I'm in a position to observe it, that in the last 20 years, for instance, the famous Golden Horseshoe, where only the rich people went to the Met, with the exception of a few standees, changed completely. If you go to, now it makes it difficult, the Met, a ticket is $25, $18 and so on, so it's tough for the middle classes to go. But we have here, and when I conduct in other cities, I see that we have many of young people, most of your generation, because the younger ones, if they're still studying, it's still, they tell me 450 is too much, too, because I don't go alone, then it's $9, and so on and forth. But if you look at the X-rated movies, they charge just as much as they go there. So they could go once or twice a year, that year too. But the interest changed tremendously. There's no question about it. I noticed that also in my teaching capacity. Naturally, I had music courses, and I preferred even to give courses to the non-music students, to introduce the non-music students to music, not to indoctrinate them or to say, no, you must do this, but just to open it up to them. And I noticed in all the schools, and the PCW and Pitt, and the two colleges, St. Vincent and Seton Hill, that I found tremendous interest. Tremendous is exaggerated. But I give you one example, since you ask. I made a test in St. Vincent. I choose 100 students. Not one music student or music education student. I excluded them. We had only music education students there. There's no conservatory. And say, you all have to go. We bus you down to Sirion Mosque for a dress rehearsal of an opera called Tosca. An opera is that and that. And what's going on in the opera is that and that. Within half an hour, I told them generally about an opera and what's going on in this very opera. I told them also, this dress rehearsal is nothing like performance because the scenery might not be ready, the principals might not sing with full voice, some of them might not even wear the costumes. Just, general, I want to see what idea you get. You have to write a paper, but you don't have to sign it. And I'm not going to get to a writing expert to find out whose handwriting it is. But you don't polish the apple. Sign an informal, as you would write to a girlfriend in New England or something like that. I want to know your opinion. That's all I want to know. And don't hesitate to say anything. So they went, and 95% of them said, we went very reluctantly. What do you have to do with opera? What's opera? That's for the other people, the rich people, or the society, you know, the establishment, overstuffed prima donnas, well, yeah, their head off. Well, I'm interested in that. And then a very high percentage, I would say at least 90%, if not more, said they were fascinated. All kind of reasons. One said they were, to amazement, discovered it's a show. It's an interesting show. And others said they were amazed how orchestra music could illustrate dramatic situations so clearly that you understood, though you didn't understand the language, what was going on and so forth. So there's the young generation. Whether they become opera lovers or not, I didn't follow it up. That wasn't the intention of it. I just wanted to open it up to them. And I told them all the time, I don't tell you you must love it or you must, but I must tell you, you must expose yourself to it. You owe yourself as a so-called academic student to expose yourself to all vistas of life, no matter what it is. Not only music, not only opera, museums, literature, anything. And then as a so-called mature adult, you can judge. You have the right to say, I don't like that, if and when you know it, but not if you're ignorant of it. That's stupidity. So I think this is what you ask me about the development. I answer again. I think there's much greater interest now among the, let's say, younger generation, whether they belong to so-called society or not, in cultural things in general, in music, because I think that rock business is an adolescent thing, and they grow it out. They grow out of it. Who can stand that noise? I tell them, you can like rock. If millions like it, there must be something to it. Just don't put it so high up that it interferes with your hearing, it will.
Do you see any musical merit at all in any of it, in the Beatles?
Yes, not musical merit, but merits. The Beatles are today classics compared to what you hear today against rock. If youngsters love the Beatles, or even like rock, I don't object to it, because I say myself, what right do I have to judge if millions of kids all over the world get crazy about it? There must be something which fascinates it. And I think what fascinates them is the rhythm. The rhythm, because there's not much melody to it, as far as I can decide. The rhythm and those texts, and that it's not crooning anymore, it's yelling now. These horrible sounds. Sometimes you come across a folk singer who does the contrary, you know, and there's bling, 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 and then it gets sentimental and the tears flow. But there are many facets, and everybody has a right to love or like or prefer what he or she wants. I dislike nothing more than one-track-minded people. One-track people. Whether that's in music, or in education, or in any other field, or people who are only out for the dollar, and for red pants, yellow shoes, and blue shirts, and swimming clubs and nightclubs. Okay, if they like it, like it. But don't be one track. What other interest you will have is up to you. And then parents, I think, have the obligation to open up all those vistas to their children. Without must, yeah, if it must be, must. I was must too. My grandfather took my hand and took me along. He didn't ask me, do you like to go to a concert? So the parents should force their kids to occupy themselves with painting somewhat, an introduction, painting, plastic, sculptures, to go to museums, to look at old art, at modern art, and so on, read something about it. Read your funnies, but read some good books too. All kind of music. If you love rock too, fine. But try a symphony concert sometimes. Try a pop concert. Try an opera. Try a musical comedy. Open yourself up to all those things. And I didn't enumerate everything. There are many other facets. This is the duty of the parents and of the teachers. The teachers very often neglect it, and the parents often neglect it. And then I think what I observed as a private person, as a parent, as a man, or as a teacher, that the environment, the unoutspoken environment, has a tremendous influence on the not upbringing of children, of growing up of their children, how they will grow up. If you have books in your house and read, and don't even tell them read too, they'll grab for a book. Stevie came home with stacks of funnies like this. I'm not exaggerating. He found a store in the north side which sold funnies, I think, for 3 cents a piece, used ones. And I say, what do you do with all those? Why don't you buy four? Then from funnies, he graduated to science fiction. From science fiction, he graduated to reading. The books that boy has, the library, still in our house, he can't transport it all to Portland. I'm ashamed that I didn't read those books. He never goes around without some pocketbooks in his pockets. All his pockets are blanking out. He looks like a slob because he's everywhere his books. But don't think they're all... I don't think he reads much fiction. But it's all things which interest him. And his kids are reading. He reads Bible stories to them. And, of course, the little ones can't read, but Richard, the oldest one, can read. But he reads the funnies now and reads other books and reads fairy tales and Disney cartoons and other cartoons. And all of this is a part of it. And if you make some music at the house and occasionally play a record of something else than rock, they might find out it's not so bad after all. You have to open up the minds of your kids. First, by showing them that you yourself are interested, widely interested, in many things of life. There's nothing wrong with a golf club, with a swimming club, with a country club, or maybe even for grown-ups with a bar. But it mustn't be self-purpose. It must be the only thing, which for some people it is, as you know only too well. Not in your family, but observation.
Do you feel then that your own European background was different than an American background? Now, I'm not speaking of your family. Your family, even though the children are American, had your European influence.
Yeah, that's undeniable. So, though we didn't plan it, you know, for instance, the children spoke only German at home because we had Frau Lauten as housekeeper. It wasn't really German, it was Kölsch, but Cologne dialect.
They spoke English with a little accent for a while.
Yeah, of course.
They did.
But as soon as they went to kindergarten, they refused to speak German. They didn't want to be different than other kids. And Stevie, even when he was in prep school, when he was at home, and went back to school, he spoke with the guttural R. But then, of course, he eliminated it again. Barbie, never. But the funny thing is that one professor said to Barbie, he was an exchange professor from Cologne at Boston University. And somehow she came to talk to him. And he said, well, you're European, aren't you? She says, no, I'm born in Pittsburgh. And she has no accent whatsoever, of course. But somehow it, fapped up.
Yeah, it wipes off.
It wipes off, you know?
It rubs off. Yeah.
It rubs off.
Excuse me. Is there anything else you would like to talk about?
Now, speaking of rubbing off, I don't want to give a false impression. I don't want to give the impression that we are European living because of the unfortunate circumstances in America. This is absolutely not the case. Not only are we grateful to this country, but we feel completely from our side as American. Now, our cultural heritage cannot be denied. We are rooted in European culture because we grew up there. We cannot eliminate that. But otherwise, we feel 100% American, and we would, in fact, like a convert is more religious than one born in a faith, we are more American than many Americans. We feel stronger about American things and are more outraged about lack of patriotism, which doesn't do necessarily mean re, 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 but true patriotism, which liberal people can have too, with some conservative don't believe. You don't have to be pink to be a liberal. And we are not pink, but we are American, and we would never want to live anywhere else. This question came often up, and it goes so far that my wife doesn't even want to go on vacation outside of America. Well, one day I'll get her to it, but only on vacation. And this then we can close with that. I conducted three international seasons, which is about 6 to 8 weeks or something, in Mexico City. And Ilse was there for the first time for about 3 weeks. And then came back because of her teaching. And I stayed naturally till the season was over. Now the first time I was completely wrapped up in the beauty of Mexico City, the cosmopolitan of the city. It's a city, there's no city in the world has as many bookstores as Mexico City, which speaks for its people. Because if there wouldn't be readers, there wouldn't be bookstores. Now this is a socialist state, but it doesn't hurt the education, it doesn't hurt in any way. I'm not propagating a socialist state, but just I enjoyed the fruits of it. And the arts are fostered. And of course it has something to do that they are Latin people, which are open, more open to art anywhere than northern people. Now, but what I wanted to say, so this was the first season. The second season, and of course we traveled around while Ilse was there in Guadalajara and all those beautiful spots, and down to Acapulco, spent a week there. So we had a good survey of Mexico, including the Aztecs' revenge. Not the Aztecs, the Aztecs' revenge.
The Aztecs, yeah.
The Aztecs. You don't know what it is?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know what the revenge is?
Sure, we've had it.
Okay, so then you know. Okay.
That's Montezuma's revenge.
Oh, Montezuma. Okay. So now, anyway. But the second time, I wasn't sad to leave. And the third time, I couldn't wait to leave. And then Ilse told me the same thing. When I landed in Chicago, between planes, the first thing I went to a little kiosk where they had hot dogs. And got an American hot dog. I felt at home again, you know, an American coffee. And Ilse told me that she did the same thing the first trip when she was there only once. When she came back, she did exactly the same thing. Went to the hot dog stand, which we usually don't eat here. But it is so American. So we want to have something American.
That's
the way we feel. I could go on and talk about American Judaism, or rather Judaism in America, and I'm deeply interested in it. In the several fractions, and rather have no fractions, but they always will be, and they should be, because we cannot all have the same ideas and ideals. But that goes too far, and I'm no expert in that field. Anyway, I'm just a listener. I happen to belong to the, what do you call it, ritual committee of my synagogue. I contribute very little, but I listen. And it's very interesting. And I like to close, since this is Jewish women who
National
Council of Jewish Women, with thanking the National Council of Jewish Women for doing all that, what they did for us immigrants when we came over, because they took us, figuratively speaking, at the hand, and many of those ladies made it, like Zina Saul, their life goal, so to speak, to help people who were completely foreign to them and had nothing to do except they happened to be also Jews, and treated them as they were their closest relatives. And this we will never forget, we cannot forget, we will not forget, and we will not forget there was a National Council of Jewish Women, for which we played also at their annual meetings with pleasure. And I must add here one more word about that man. Like Fritz Reiner did not know how much I adore him, Dr. Freehoff doesn't know how much I adore him. Oh yeah, I heard him speak at another time where I was so immensely proud, because of him to be a Jew. That was at PCW, which is called now Chatham College. It was not a commencement, it was some assembly, I don't know, and they invited Dr. Freer to speak there. And those girls were floored.
Yeah.
You know what speaker he was.
Oh.
How he... You couldn't escape him. I'm so sad that I didn't have more years to go and hear him regularly.
Yeah, I did.
Is all. Thank you very much for your interest.
This is Mary Harrison, the interviewer, and I just want to interject one thing, and that is because the Pittsburgh Opera is such a current thing in the life of Dr. Karp, we decided, because we have a very current resume, that we would not even ask Dr. Karp, because this interview, which is almost 3 hours long, was done in one sitting, and we felt that it would be a great imposition to start on something as current and as contemporary as this. So this will be filled in on our notes. I also would like to add, this is Mary Harrison again, in completing this tape, that as decided by the Council of Jewish Women and this committee, that two people would ideally interview, which we did. So I would like to say that I, Mary Harrison, interviewed Dr. Karp and took charge of the tape recorder, while Ruthie Lieber took the notes and transcripts.